and welcome to episode 4 of the Doorstops podcast with Dr. Cody Price. In case you missed it, previous and future episodes of the Doorstops podcast can be found on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorstops podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at Ohio Doorsteps. Well, let's get started. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and I would like to reintroduce you guys to my guests today, Melissa Benson and Ben Horn, who are both attorneys with the Legal Aid Society of Columbus, who previously spoke to us about evictions. So as a recap, Ben is the managing attorney of the housing team at the Legal Aid Society of Columbus, and Melissa is a staff attorney on the team. They both represent tenants in evictions, help people maintain their subsidized housing, and work to improve housing conditions for Columbus's tenants. Thank you guys again for coming in today to do this episode. I've asked them to go further into legal issues kind of regarding housing conditions, exclusively kind of for rental housing. What are some of these major condition issues in rental housing that are happening around the state?
We hear of all manner of conditions issues from tenants that we represent. I think that right now, because it's summer and it's hot, we hear about broken air conditioning quite a lot. We also hear about there are no screens in the windows, things like that. And conversely, in the winter, we hear about a lack of heat. Oftentimes, we'll learn the tenants are heating their homes with the oven. Other, you know, year-round problems, lots of times we get calls because there's no water service in the home. Usually because the bill hasn't been paid. Oftentimes it's just a matter of calling code enforcement. The code enforcement officer will call the owner of the building and say, you need to get the water bill paid because these people have to be vacated if they're living in a house without water. Another issue that we see a lot are problems with pests. A lot of homes with rodent infestations or with cockroaches or bed bugs, which are the most nefarious pest of all because they're very hard to get rid of and it's expensive to get rid of them as well. And then another issue that we learn of is that tenants are living in homes that may have lead paint. Oftentimes they will call us because the child was at the doctor's office and got tested and we learn that the child has elevated blood lead levels. And so they contact us about that issue.
Yeah, and so kind of getting more into this lead-based paint issue. So looking at our office's housing needs assessment, over two-thirds of occupied housing units in Ohio are old enough to contain lead-based paint. And of these older housing units, almost 430,000 are either home to young children or have young children present at least 8 hours a week, and which are considered to be at risk of lead-based paint hazard. So the CDC identifies any child's blood lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter as abnormal or dangerously high and presenting an undue risk for the development of long-term mental and behavioral disabilities. So when families are really put into this situation and they find out that there is lead-based paint in their house or that they have other housing condition issues, is it really better for them to stay and fight? Or are they better off to move and risk ending up in a similar situation or worse condition?
I think that question actually really hits on the heart of this issue, which is that so much of the housing stock, specifically housing stock that is available to low-income families, is aging, and those conditions issues, issues like lead-based paint and just general conditions issues, permeate that housing stock everywhere. So leaving one unit that has problems doesn't mean that when you move, you're not going to be in a similar situation the next place that you go. In the city of Columbus, the city is actually filing nuisance abatement cases against properties that have high lead levels where children have been tested, remain there. And there are grant funds available for owners, low-income owners, to be able to do lead remediation on their homes. And if a landlord has low-income tenants, that they can also access these grant funds. And so being able to access that money and having the opportunity to remediate that situation, I think, is a better plan in the long run, both because you maintain the housing that you're in, and you are also improving that housing and stopping it from being a part of that cycle. However, that option isn't always available to people. So I think for families, it really kind of ends up being their own personal call as to whether they're going to stay somewhere or go. But it's a huge struggle for people when they don't have the funds to move somewhere else.
And just adding on to that, in Columbus Public Health has a pretty robust program to help tenants who are living in homes that have been identified as having high lead levels. And depending on what the level is, the services may be different. But if it's one thing that regardless of the lead level for the child, the health department will go to the home. They will use a HEPA-VAC to get rid of the lead chips, that sort of thing that may be visible and on the floor by the windows. They will educate the family on ways to reduce the risk of children ingesting lead. And so I would always encourage that step, that the tenant family contact a local health department just to ensure that their family stays safe.
And so how can legal aid help with this issue? I mean, you've mentioned a lot of these housing issues, if it's air conditioning, not having water, if there's lead-based paint. What is this housing condition process? What are the steps taken? What are the things involved?
The process that we would recommend, and that's sort of outlined in the Ohio statute, the first step of that is to notify the owner of the property or the landlord of the issue, the conditions issue that needs to be remedied. So generally we'll tell tenants the first thing to do is talk to your landlord about it, put it in writing if you don't get an immediate response, and then the tenant should wait a reasonable amount of time depending on the issue to give the landlord a chance to correct the condition. And if the condition is not corrected after a reasonable amount of time, and that can be no more than 30 days, then various options open up for the tenant, including a process called rent escrow, where the tenant goes to the local municipal court and starts a rent escrow account and basically deposits rent with the court instead of giving it to the landlord. The tenant cannot get evicted for non-payment of rent when they escrow their rent. Occasionally that will happen, but when a tenant escrows the rent, the court will notify the landlord, hey, this is what's happening, that your tenant has started a rent escrow account, and so that should clue the landlord in that that's what's happening and it's just not a non-payment situation. The end result hopefully being that by doing this, the landlord will be motivated to make the repair, bring the property into compliance with city code, and upon doing that, the money will be released to the landlord. So that's the process that we start out with. There's also the issue of, do we want to involve a government inspection? Sometimes tenants don't want to do that. They worry that's going to escalate the situation too much. And those are all valid concerns. There's a lot of retaliation that happens when tenants complain of conditions issues. But it also gives more options to the tenant because they now, if they call code enforcement inspects and finds code violations, that adds an extra layer of pressure on the landlord to make the repairs, because if the repairs aren't made, ultimately that can lead to fines from the city. And it also provides corroboration that there is actually a problem. So tenants don't have to go into court with, you know, photographs and, you know, bringing in a jar of discolored water to prove that there's a plumbing problem. Instead, they can just point to the fact that a city official looked at the property and found there to be problems. So we encourage tenants to speak out about conditions issues, not be quiet about them, because tenants need to live in safe places. And when tenants get cowed into being quiet about conditions problems, it can lead to serious results. There have been, you know, home fires because a tenant is renting a place that doesn't have heat and they're trying to use kerosene heaters, or they start an electrical fire because they've got 8 or 10 things plugged in trying to heat the home, or they're using an oven. And so there's a lot of problems that can result from not dealing with the conditions issues.
I don't know if you said it, like, so when does legal aid step in? So it's just like they've made notice of their air conditioner is not working. They might go to do the rent escrow, notify their landlord, it's been 30 days. Is that when they contact legal aid?
Tenants can contact us just because they're starting out trying to get their air conditioning fixed. And we will accept them as clients and walk them through the process. We often help give written notice to the landlord about the problems. We often will help coordinate with code enforcement to ensure that there is an inspection done. And then if it gets to the point where the problem's gone on and nothing's being done, beyond the rent escrow process that we've talked about, there are also affirmative lawsuits that we can file. They're called nuisance abatement actions, and we can file those in court, basically saying to the court that we need the owner to bring the property into compliance with local housing and health codes. So that's a pretty powerful tool that we bring out just when we have a very stubborn, you know, landlord situation.
And so looking at these type of issues, you kind of mentioned that you'll deal with air conditioning issues in the summertime, you have heating issues in the wintertime, but how do these issues kind of vary geographically? Do you see a concentration of some of these housing condition issues happening in central Ohio versus southeastern Ohio? Are you seeing any type of regional differences with these issues?
I think the issues themselves are fairly universal throughout the state. The struggle regionally comes more with the resources to address it. I think that when you're in a larger city like Columbus, we have code enforcement here. We have a wonderful, robust code enforcement department that will come out and inspect when a tenant contacts them or we contact them with a problem, and they'll issue a report. And they're used to coming to court and testifying about those issues. The city of Columbus, Franklin County, has an environmental court that is specifically set up to deal with housing conditions issues. I practiced for nearly a decade in Chillicothe, Ohio, before this, and covered several rural counties when I was there, and the resources were just not the same. Several of the counties that I worked in had not even code enforcement, no city code, no housing code, no building code. And the ones that did would have one inspector to cover an entire county or an entire city, and they just did not have the ability to come and do inspections for us. Our colleagues in rural areas are struggling with how to bring the kinds of cases that we bring routinely because they don't have that built-in expert witness there. So that definitely makes things more difficult when the tenant has to bring pictures of the water, you know, the sewage standing in their basement in order to prove that there was a problem with the sewage as opposed to the report. And even then, you know, the photograph versus a report from a government agency has a completely different impact on the court.
We've talked a lot about housing condition issues varying geographically by population, this urban-rural divide, but I really kind of am interested what happens on the other side of the table. So we've talked a lot about how the tenants, kind of their process, but is there any retaliation with the landlords? How are they dealing with these issues?
We encounter a lot of hesitation when we tell tenants to write a letter to the landlord and request repairs, or we advise them to call 311, which is Columbus's number, if you want to get a code officer out. Oftentimes they say, well, they have two concerns. One is that the landlord will retaliate against them, try to evict them. Another concern is that if code enforcement shows up, the property will be found to be unfit for human habitation, and that can lead code enforcement to issue a vacate order on the property. So then the tenant has nowhere to live. And these are legitimate concerns that we have to listen to. So regarding retaliation, one cycle that we've learned of when we help tenants is a lot of the properties that are kept in poorest condition, the landlords will only rent them out on a month-to-month basis. The reason being that allows a landlord to quickly end the tenancy if the tenant does complain about things or does call code enforcement. So one thing we've been trying to do at Legal Aid is address that problem by filing affirmative suits when a landlord does that. So if we find that a code enforcement officer visited a place on the sixth day of the month, and then a couple days later, the landlord showed up with a notice terminating the tenancy, the month-to-month tenancy, we will now file a retaliatory eviction claim against the landlord. So, you know, on a case-by-case basis, we can intervene in those situations, but I think it's also an area where we could have better rules in Columbus anyways. There are very strong retaliation rules, this is municipal codes, against retaliation in Cleveland and Cincinnati, and we're hoping that City Council may pass something to make it more robust here in Columbus as well.
It is illegal for a landlord to retaliate against a tenant and file an eviction or raise their rent or take any other action as a means of punishing them for complaining about their rights. That means escrowing their rent, requesting repairs, calling code, any of that stuff. The statute, Ohio law, says that should not happen. The catch comes in where the tenant is in that month-to-month tenancy because those can be terminated for no reason whatsoever. And so it then ends up being a burden that's put on the tenant in that situation to prove that the landlord was actually retaliating when they were doing this thing that they're allowed to do anyway, as opposed to some other situations that we've seen where, for example, we had a tenant that had a dog in the house and they weren't supposed to have the dog. The lease said no pets, but the landlord had known the dog was there for years. And finally, when they called code, the landlord gave him a notice to leave because they had a dog. And because we were able to demonstrate that the landlord had known for years that they had this dog and hadn't cared, we were able to show that it was retaliatory and defeat the eviction. But in a month-to-month tenancy situation, it's much harder to prove that because there's a presumption that the landlord is allowed to stop the tenancy at any time with the proper notice.
And one thing that we have to always keep in mind is that the landlord and the tenant have a relationship. And so, you know, there are rules against retaliation. There are things we can do to intervene legally. But if we want to prevent displacement long term, the best way to do that is to preserve the landlord-tenant relationship. So when we request repairs, we don't start threatening that we're going to sue anybody. We just nicely ask for repairs. And I think tenants need to, you know, take that approach. Start with just asking. If necessary, let's write. If necessary, let's call code. All along thinking, I'd like to live in a safe, decent place, but I also don't want to have a landlord that's retaliating and trying to get me to move. And it can be difficult for tenants because oftentimes they're under the landlord's thumb for some other reason, like they are behind, maybe they couldn't pay the full security deposit when they moved in, so they are paying that off month by month, and they know that if they complain, the landlord will have an argument that they're behind in rent. Or like Melissa mentioned, they may have a pet that the landlord's turned a blind eye to, but the tenant knows if I complain, now there's going to be a problem about the pet. You know, so there are a lot of considerations there.
Yeah, and so I think moving on, kind of getting with a different population subset, kind of looking at refugees and immigrants. Based on our housing needs assessment, there have been about 32,000 refugees who have resettled in Ohio between 2002 and 2017, with nearly about half of these Ohio refugees arrival in Franklin County. I was just wondering, like, what kind of housing condition issues might this population face? I mean, there's probably a language barrier. There's probably a huge income resource availability. Do you see a higher number of cases of these housing conditions with rental housing with an immigrant or refugee population?
I think that it is easier for certain landlords and certain property owners to prey on people who are less sophisticated, both in the rules and regulations that apply to this housing here and who are just new to the area and they have a language barrier. We have worked with several groups in town that assist immigrants dealing with conditions issues. We've also worked with the city on this. We had a large case about a year and a half ago with an apartment complex on the north side of Columbus that was occupied primarily by Somali and Congolese refugees that had some pretty significant conditions issues. We worked with those tenants in conjunction with the Somali Community Association of Ohio as kind of a go-between agency that provided a lot of wonderful translation services and organization services for us as we did this. And we represented 18 of these families in helping them to escrow their rent. And then eventually when the city filed a case against the complex for failure to bring it up to code, we represented the tenants in that case as well. So it is definitely an issue that we see. We are aware of several other complexes throughout the region with immigrant populations that are struggling with conditions issues. And I think that one of the barriers that we do see is that immigrants are not used to having the code protections that we do and are not used to having the escrow procedures. And so they don't think that there's something that can be done about it, that their mindset, the laws in the countries that they've come from oftentimes just would never even address these kinds of issues. It was never something that they had to deal with. So there's a challenge in that. There's a huge fear of retaliation I've seen from immigrant communities, whether or not that's realistic or whether or not that's a fear that they actually should be having. And I think that that is probably very experiential, particularly with refugee populations where the rule of law was not what it is here where they came from. And so they don't expect that there are laws that will protect them in the same ways.
So I think that it gets back to almost this huge education piece, really educating people about the process, the rights that they have. At the eviction talks that we were discussing in the last episode, do they have a high show up of immigrant or refugee populations?
I have not seen large numbers of immigrants or refugees that come to the city's panels. They've been located throughout the city in various communities. Honestly, a lot of what we've seen, we do see some tenants and some landlords who come, but a lot of social service agencies and community members who are otherwise interested have also been coming to those, which is helpful in that they can then take the information that they get back to the people that they are assisting who are dealing with these issues, and it spreads the information even further.
And so I know we've covered a lot of different topics in this episode, so kind of getting at different varying levels of housing condition issues. Is there anything else that you guys want to discuss or major takeaways from this episode that you think our listeners should know?
I think as far as housing conditions go, the major takeaway that I would hope people would get is that there's been, with the aging housing stock that we have in Columbus and throughout the state and throughout the country, there's a lot of work that's going to need to be done on housing to make sure that it remains safe and stable for families, especially vulnerable families who are much more likely to be in that older housing stock renting and not have the ability to make the repairs and protect themselves.
All right. I know you guys previously suggested some books on our last one, specifically To Kill a Mockingbird and Evicted, but do you guys have another book or maybe a play that you guys would like to suggest to our listeners?
Well, I would suggest there's a musical out there called Hamilton, which I was lucky to watch in Chicago.
And I saw in Cleveland.
And Melissa's seen it as well. I think at Legal Aid we like Hamilton because Hamilton was an underdog. He came from an impoverished situation and really worked hard and became successful. He's the founding father on the $10 bill. And I think as legal aid attorneys consider ourselves underdogs a lot of the time, and we consider our clients underdogs, and so we root for them as well.
So thank you both so much for coming in and speaking to us about these condition issues in rental housing. To my listeners, please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorstops podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account @OhioDoorsteps. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and this is Doorsteps.